morning, and thank you for standing by, and welcome to the NOAA-NASA 2016 Climate Conference Call. Your lines are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star followed by the number one to ask a question. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Brady Phillips of NOAA. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Michelle. Again, my name is Brady Phillips with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, D.C., and I'll be facilitating the call today. And during the call, we'll feature two short presentations by NOAA and NASA scientists on the 2016 global temperature data and some other key weather and climate events from the year. This will be followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation that our speakers will be talking to today can be downloaded at http://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/sotc/briefings. That's briefings. And today our speakers are Gavin Schmidt, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City, and Deke Arndt, the chief of the Climate Monitoring Branch at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina. Our first speaker we'll start with will be Gavin Schmidt from NASA. Gavin?
Yes. Thank you for joining us today. I'm going to give a first brief overview of what the NASA GIS temperature data looks like. This is an effort that we've been doing here at GIS for about 35 years, and so it has a long tradition behind it. We give annual press releases, we have been doing so for many, many years. If you go to slide two, you can see the map of the NASA 2006 and 2016 annual mean, and the scale is both in centigrade and Fahrenheit for both the Europeans and the Americans and among us. And you can see that pretty much the entire globe is red, indicating a positive anomaly with respect to the baseline period of 1951 to 1980. In particular, you can see that the Arctic is very red. The anomalies there are above 4 degrees in places and contribute quite markedly to the global mean record-setting temperature that we have, which is 0.99 degrees Celsius above the baseline period, and that's about 1.2 degrees C above the late 19th century. So in Fahrenheit, that's 1.8 Fahrenheit above the baseline period, or a little bit more than that compared to the 19th century. This was the warmest year of the NASA record by about 0.12 degrees C compared to the last year, which was 2015, which was the record warmest year then, and then 2014, which was the record warmest year then. And to reiterate, there's you can see a very strong signal of the kind of remnant El Nino pattern in the tropical Pacific, but really you're seeing warmth throughout the world, higher on land than in the ocean, higher in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere, higher in the Arctic most of all, and patterns that we have grown quite familiar with both from modeling and from the observations. Deke.
Hi, this is Deke from NOAA. Thank you for joining us. I'm happy to represent NOAA, in particular the National Centers for Environmental Information, where we keep and steward the data that provides the context to which we can compare today's values. So slide three shows a very similar map to the one that Gavin just showed. This is based on NOAA's analysis. One slide different from this map to the previous one is we have slid the comparison period forward to a recent 30-year period, 1981 to 2010. That causes a little more blue to show up on the map because we are comparing to a relatively warmer period. But the overall patterns are the same. Pretty profound warmth in the northern hemisphere, the high-latitude northern hemisphere in particular. You can see that we are a little more conservative and extrapolating into the Arctic, but we do pick up on some of that Arctic warmth, particularly in the Arctic coastal regions of North America and Asia. So Siberia, Alaska, and much of Western Canada, very warm. This was also the warmest year on record for our analysis, which, like the GIST temp analysis, dates to 1880. It was warmer than the 20th century average by about 1.69 degrees Fahrenheit. That is warmer than the previous record, which is 2015. You can see some annotations about which parts of the world were warm. A major difference between 2016 and 2015. 2015 was really driven by a very warm tropical Pacific and North Pacific and Indian Ocean. This year, those areas are still warm, but not quite as dramatically so as they were in 2015. It was really global warmth that we saw in 2016, even more so than 2015. So while the last two slides have kind of shown the year in detail, the next two will show the year in the context of the long-term trend. And so slide number four is the NOAA analysis. So this is a time series of the annual temperatures compared to the 20th century average. So the individual dots are years from 1880 on the left through 2016 on the right. The shaded bars represent averages for the decades, which were calculated. You can see that 2016 and 2015 and the NOAA analysis are kind of twin years, both of them rising much above the record, a clear warming trend since the mid to late 20th century. This was the third year in a row in our analysis to set a new record. That is happened only once before in our record, and that was in the years 1939 through 1941, which now don't even sit in the top 30 of the record. You can see in the upper left corner an analysis based on the uncertainties associated with our data and our analysis. We project 2016 as a 62% likelihood when considering the envelope of uncertainties that it was indeed the warmest year on record. And really the only other contender for that rank is 2015. I think the next slide will show a similar analysis for NASA, and I'll hand it back to Gavin.
Thanks, Dee. Yeah, so this is the same basic analysis for the NASA GIST temp time series. The overall structure is very similar. The divergence between the two series has increased a little bit in recent years, and that's mostly associated with how we treat the Arctic. And the warming in the Arctic, which we'll talk about in a little bit, has really been exceptional. And what you decide to do when you're interpolating across the Arctic actually turns out to make a bit of a difference. And in particular, if you look at the probability that we think that 2016 was in fact the warmest year on record in the real world, with all of the caveats that we always have about that we are estimating this, we estimate that it's like a 96% probability that 2016 is indeed the warmest year on record. And again, with only 2015 being in the a very, very minor contender to that. The key thing scientifically is really the trends. Getting hung up on the exact nature of the records is interesting, and there's lots of technical work that can be done there. But the main take-home response here is that the trends that we've been seeing since the 1970s are continuing and have not paused in any way. If you go to the next slide, we can look at how the influence of El Niño and La Niña have impacted temperature. This is the monthly data from NOAA, color-coded, roughly speaking, by whether there is an El Niño in progress or a La Niña in blue, El Niño in red, and kind of neutral conditions in gray. The exact definition of an El Nino depends a little bit on the on different meteorological offices. So this is just an approximation. But you can see, for instance, that when we start to get into an El Nino state in the tropical Pacific, we start to see a lagged response in the global mean temperature towards warmer temperatures. We saw that in 2015 and 2016, but we've also seen it, of course, in 1997, 98, also in 2010, and going back even further. So we anticipate that when we have got an El Nino at the beginning of the year, we expect that the year will be slightly warmer than the trend compared to, for instance, a La Nina year. Part of the records that you're seeing, both in 2015 and 2016, were related to the presence of an El Nino. But of course, there have been El Ninos before, but the long-term trend is not because of the El Ninos. That's because of the ongoing warming of the planet, mainly by greenhouse gases. Back to you, Deke.
So landing on slide number 7, Gavin mentioned the differences in our analyses and how they sometimes give rise to slight differences in the analysis of individual years. And so just to provide some broader context on that point, we have thrown in some other major analyses, some other major methods and groups that track global temperature in this graphic. And so what you see are 6 lines that represent 6 different ways of analyzing the global temperature anomaly. They are the NOAA and NASA data sets that we've been talking to already, an analysis from the Met Office, which is the UK Weather Service, a Calton and Way, which is an adaptation of that data set, and then a Berkeley Earth, an academic group located at the University of California, Berkeley, here in the U.S. And then finally, the raw NOAA data analysis. So I'll talk about that in a second. But you can see that especially since the mid-20th century, the analyses, while they have slight differences from year to year, they are capturing the same long-term signal. It's a pretty unmistakable signal, especially when looking across these 5 different analyses. I like to say that these data sets are all singing the same song, even if they're hitting different notes along the way. The pattern is very clear. We have included the uncorrected raw version of the NOAA data. This is if the data were taken strictly as observed and no corrections or no effort was made to understand the differences in reporting observation platforms and data handling along the way. And it would, in fact, imply a slightly steeper warming trend if we did not correct for issues or changes in the way we've observed. And the main changes have been the way we've taken sea surface temperature observations, switching largely from buckets thrown over the sides of ships to an engine intake method. That's actually the major difference between the uncorrected and the corrected versions. But again, these methods, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses, they all have their own analytical method, again, capturing the same signal in the long term. With that, moving on to slide number 8, and this is zooming back the other way into a much more finer detail. So Gavin showed the monthly value since 1981, and here we are zooming in to the monthly part of the record since 2010. One of the things that was unique in 2016, especially in relation to the prior year, was we had the last 8 months of 2015 and the first 8 months of 2016 set or tied records for those months on the individual record. And so the inset graphic just shows each month's temperature anomaly versus the 20th century average since January 2010. The bars that are colored in gold were the months that set or tied a record at the time. And so we've been in this era, again, near the very top of what we've observed. And as Gavin mentioned earlier, the presence of an El Nino, even a modest El Nino, will tend to push global monthly temperatures at or above record values. And you can see that quite clearly in this zoom into recent conditions. With that, I think I'll hand it back to Gavin for slide 9.
So people are always very interested in what other time series are saying as we go up through the atmosphere. We have different kinds of data that we're collecting throughout the atmosphere, from radio sondes, so individual sondes that are launched around the planet on a constant basis. But we also have satellite records of the lower troposphere, mid troposphere, and lower stratosphere records. And if we start at the top, the lower stratosphere. So this is around 15 to 20 kilometers above the surface. This has been cooling. We think we understand why it's been cooling. It's mainly because of ozone depletion and some part of the increase in carbon dioxide. But this, the lower stratosphere had its coldest year on record, which is consistent with the warming that we're seeing below. The middle troposphere records, there's four different groups that analyze that data, and you can see there's a bit of a spread between them, but all of those show the warmest mid troposphere temperatures on record in all of their analyses as well. At the lower troposphere, there are two different records. And both of those also showed that 2016 was the warmest year on record. And if you look at the different levels that come from the radio sonde data, then as you go up from the surface, you're seeing totally consistently that 2016 was the warmest on record, going back to the 1950s. Up until you get to about 40,000 feet, which is about the tropopause. So what we're seeing at the surface, what we're seeing spatially, is totally coherent with what we're seeing in the atmosphere. There really isn't any kind of discrepancy or puzzle about what's going on in 2016. And then if we go to the slide 10, what we've done is we've highlighted just the Arctic to kind of really kind of highlight why what's going on in the Arctic is mattering. As you can see from the main graphs, both March and September, Arctic sea ice extents have been on a pretty steady downward trend, and that's true for all of the individual months and for the minimum as well. And that's coincident this year with a really astounding, almost a 3 degree Celsius anomaly in the Arctic compared to the baseline period, which is almost a 4 degree warming compared to the pre-industrial. That's really a very, very large change. We expect the Arctic to have more variability. You can see that compared to the global mean line in the inset figure. But we're seeing very, very large changes in the Arctic, and so it's no wonder that the impacts of change are being felt there first and foremost. With that, I'll pass back to Deke to discuss some more of the Arctic and Antarctic sea ice issues.
Hi, so slide 11 zooms into the Arctic sea ice extent on a day-by-day basis. So the previous slide kind of showed longer-term patterns over the years. And what this graphic does is it zooms in to the Arctic sea ice extent from January 1st on the left through December 31st on the right. The year 2016 is noted in the heavy red line. The gray line, the dark gray trace, is the average for the 30 years of 1981 to 2010. The light gray envelope around that line are two standard deviations, or two sigmas, which are important to scientists, about how the variability that was shown during that period. And then the other traces show various important years during the time. So 1982, which was the largest average annual extent in blue, and the previous smallest annual extent in 2012 is in orange. And you can see that, and then the day-by-day record, so to speak, in the dotted stippled lines as well. You can see that 2016 certainly scraped the bottom of this record, and at times, especially during the Northern Hemisphere spring months, and then the last two and a half months of the year, set new records for small sea ice extent. When you average that across the 365 days of the year, 2016 was indeed the smallest average annual sea ice extent, although we did not set a new minimum in September when the sea ice traditionally shrinks to its smallest extent. The next slide shows the Antarctic, and it has a few features compared to the previous slide. The Antarctic tends to retreat more fully each year and re-establish much of its sea ice extent in what we call first-year ice. So the expansion is larger, and then the contraction is larger in a normal year. So much of what we see in the Antarctic reflects what is going on this year as opposed to the Arctic, which has a strong memory of previous years because of the loss of multi-year ice. And you can see that, as is the case in most years, the Antarctic was quite variable from month to month. 2016 was bounced around in that envelope of prior observations until the end of the year, when it did indeed drop off precipitously from the long-term record. And so the combination of the end-of-year state of the Antarctic sea ice extent and the end-of-the-year Arctic sea ice extent was truly record in a global standpoint, putting those two together. And these graphics are just designed to show the day-by-day detail associated with those two records. And then finally, on slide 13, what we're looking at on the right, in the blue bars in particular, is the trend in snow cover extent in the Northern Hemisphere. So this is by month from July, which is the beginning of the snow cover season, through June, which is the end of the snow cover season. What have we seen over time, changes in snow cover extent? And we can see, and 2016 supported this pattern very strongly, as that the late spring and then the late summer, early fall months are seeing the most rapid declines in snow cover extent. 2016 was no different. We have included these slides about sea ice and snow cover extent because while global temperature is a very important and very direct indicator of the changes that we see in our planet, there are so many interconnected systems and data sets that describe those systems within the climate system. But this is just a glimpse into some of the consequences and other indicators of the planetary climate system. And I will leave this at that. I think I'm turning it back to Brady. We completed our prepared remarks.
Great. Thank you to both Gavin and Deke for your presentations. And we will now turn it over to some Q&A. So, operator, can you please tell everyone how they can ask a question?
Thank you, sir.
The first call. Thanks.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question or you have any comments, you may press star followed by the number one. Again, that is star one if you do have any questions. Seth Borenstein, you may ask your question, and please state your company name.
Thank you. It's thanks for doing this together. It's Seth Borenstein at AT. I have one for Deke and one for Gavin. Actually, it's a multi-part for Deke. Deke, with the 0.07 degrees over 2015, which is not quite as big as what NASA finds. Obviously, you give the 62%. Would you characterize that 0.07 difference as small, or would you say it is statistically significant? In other words, how large would you say? And is there a way you could quantify the climate change role versus the El Nino role? The anthropogenic climate change role versus the El Nino role in the NOAA data. And for Gavin, this is a simple question that I've asked you before. Can you give us a number for 2016, not an anomaly in terms of a temperature? You give us an over the mean. Can you give us what that mean it is over? I'm sorry, but editors always ask that question.
Thanks, Seth. This is Deke. So to address your first question, 0.04 degrees Celsius or 0.07 degrees Fahrenheit is not a huge margin to set a new record, but it is larger than the typical margin, or at least the margins we've seen in recent years, with the exception being 2015 over 2014, which was a huge margin. I would describe in our record that, you know, we just, like the statistics showed, we're fairly confident that 2016 is the warmest year on record. I think Gavin will probably speak to the coverage in the Arctic helping their data set increase the confidence in that assessment. As for El Nino's role in boosting an individual year's temperature to new record, if you refer to slide 6, this is a slide that Gavin spoke to very well earlier. But one thing that you see, if you look at the major El Nino events, the red bars in 1982-83, 1997-98, and again 2015 and 16, you can see that on average they boost those months about 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit above kind of the trend line, if you eyeball it that way. And so in that regard, and it's fairly consistent. Some of the earlier months in those periods are a little less. Some of the later months in those periods are a little more. But if you take that as, and this is not a rigorous scientific analysis by any means, but you can take that 0.2, 0.3 value and compare it to 2016 being about 0.9 degrees above the 20th century average. And if you do that kind of eyeball math, you can say that this El Nino may have contributed about a quarter to a third of what we see versus the 20th century average. It's fairly consistent. I think the beauty of this graphic that we prepared is you can see that the El Nino periods are getting warmer in red. If you just look at the blue colors, the La Nina periods are getting warmer. And if you just look at the neutral periods, the gray, those periods are getting warmer as well. So I'll hand it over to Gavin with that.
So if I can actually just kind of make a comment on what Deke said, you can statistically try and remove the impact of El Nino or ENSO on the annual mean temperatures, and we have done so for the GIS record, and we estimate that for 2015 there was a boost from El Nino of about 0.05 Celsius. And 2016, there was a boost of about 0.12 Celsius. If you compare that to the long-term trend, or the difference from the baseline, which was about 0.99, then the modern trend is contributing, you know, 90% of the signal, and the El Nino is contributing about 10% of the signal. Those numbers vary a little bit in exactly how you do that correction or what baseline that you're really talking about, but that's about right. You know, you get a 10% boost, but it's only happening, and we're only seeing these records because of the long-term trends that are driven not by El Nino but by effectively greenhouse gases. So to answer Seth's other question, and yes, people do ask us this all the time, and there's a real good reason why we don't give an absolute temperature. It turns out that the absolute temperature for the whole planet is a harder number to estimate than just the difference from one year to the next. And so we can make statements about the differences in year by year at the tenths, sometimes even hundredths of a degree level, but we don't know the absolute temperature of the planet that well. And so if you take one number that is not very well known and you add it to another number that is very well known, it doesn't suddenly become more accurate. There's a story about a guard at a museum. And somebody asks him, how old is this dinosaur? And he says it's 65 million years and 10 years old. And they say, well, how can you know that so precisely? And he says, well, when I came here, they said it was 65 million years ago, and I've been there for 10 years now. So that's how old it is. Okay, that's the same kind of issue. So when we take the anomaly and we try and add it to an estimate of the global mean absolute number, what we're actually doing is we're confusing numbers that have very different accuracies, and we're not. It would be misleading of us to give that number. And so I've been a little bit of an evangelist on this particular issue, and maybe that is upsetting your editor, but I'm sorry about that. But there's nothing I can do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Brian Sullivan, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
Hi, I'm Brian Sullivan from Bloomberg News. I have two quick questions. One is, we're in a transition period here with the new government coming in. Is there a takeaway here that the new government should be getting from this data? And then secondly, are there any clear consequences to what's happening in the Arctic and the Antarctic? Are you seeing any kind of connections with the weather further downstream from those two areas?
Hey, Brian, this is Deke. We provide these assessments and these analyses for the benefit of the American people, and that's kind of what we do. Our mission is strictly to describe the state of the climate and our methods on how we got there. So as regarding your second question about the state of the Arctic and the Antarctic, both areas are very different from each other. They're both important for global weather patterns and for seasonal climate patterns as well, and there has been recent research that suggests that changes in the Arctic may be manifesting themselves in changes in the jet stream and associated weather patterns that we see down here in the mid-latitudes. I can recommend some leaders in that research if you want to talk about that a little more deeply.
Sure, I'd like that if you could.
Yeah, I'll follow up with you, Brian.
Okay, no problem. Thanks.
Thank you. Alistair Doyle, you may ask your question, and please state your company name.
Wonderful. Thanks very much. Alistair Doyle from Reuters News Agency. I'm just wondering, please, what either of you can say, please, about 2017. Will this year be colder? And, you know, with this extreme spike we've had, is there going to be a danger that we're setting ourselves up for there will be a pause or a hiatus in this warming that will be feeding this skepticism about climate change again as there was in the early 2000s, 10 years ago? Thanks very much.
If I could take that. The analysis that I briefly mentioned, where you try and correct for the ENSO effect in the annual mean, you can use it to make predictions for what's going to happen in the future. Basically, you're breaking everything down into the long-term trend and then the interannual variability that's associated with El Nino. And because we're right now starting this year with a very mild La Nina, slightly neutral to La Nina situation, we expect that to give a small negative push to next year's temperature. But because the long-term trends are so clear, it's still going to be a top 5 year in our analysis. I'm pretty confident about that, but it is unlikely to be another record year. But it will be, I think, the third year above a degree, above the pre-industrial, the late 19th century. So it will be a continuation of those long-term trends. Whether people suddenly want to say after a record that, now we've cooled because there was a record last year. I think people are savvy enough to see how transparent that is.
Thanks. So just to triple check, this year will be a top 5 year, 2017, yeah?
My personal prediction is that 2017 will be a top 5 year, possibly the second warmest, but could be as low down as the fifth warmest.
Yeah, terrific. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Damian Carrington, you may ask your question, and please state your company name.
Hello, thank you. Damien Carrington from The Guardian. Deep kind of answered this question, but maybe ask Gavin as well. I mean, is there any message you would give to the incoming administration based on the data that you presented today?
Yeah, this is Deke. Again, we prepare these data and these analyses to share with the American people, and that's what we do. I repeat my previous answer.
And again, as a reminder to reporters, we are sticking to the science of the 2016 global temperature data. So please, if you have questions related to that, queue up the call. Thanks.
Once again, that is star one if you do have any questions or comments. Chris Mooney, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
Hi, this is Chris Mooney with the Washington Post. I'm just wondering if either of our experts could comment on the Hadley Center also putting out numbers, and they've got a really small gap between 2015 and 2016, with 2016 barely edging it over. And I don't know if you know why they would diverge from what you're presenting.
If I can take a first crack at that. So all of the groups coordinated this year so that we would release the data all together to, I think, save everybody a little bit of time and confusion. The different groups have different methodologies in how they piece together the stations, how we deal with inhomogeneities in the measuring systems and placements of stations and the like. But this year, the big difference is really how we treat the Arctic. So the groups that try and fill in the Arctic as best they can, so NASA GISTEMP, the Cowton and Way extension of the Hadley Center, the Crew T4 data set, and the reanalyses, for instance, that come from ECMWF or from MERA2, those are all showing 2016 to be a much clearer record than the groups that are not extrapolating into the Arctic. So when, I mean, there's reasons not to do that because you don't want to extrapolate too far, of course. But effectively, what you're assuming there is that the Arctic is warming at the same rate as the global mean. But our analysis demonstrates that the Arctic is warming at around 2 to 3 times as fast as the global mean. And so as the Arctic continues to warm, that will be the cause of continuing divergences between the groups. And it's something that that I think we all need to be thinking about more carefully about how these things get presented.
Thank you.
Do you want to add anything to that?
No, I completely agree. This is Deke. Completely agree. In the big picture, again, this is comparing our work and comparing strengths and weaknesses, and understanding that actually helps us all make better analyses in the long run. It's a healthy thing to be comparing our results and understanding how we got there. In the big picture, as far as long-term change goes, again, I think Gavin made this point earlier, a single data point and where we place a single data point with our analyses doesn't have a whole lot to do with our understanding of the climate system, but the fact that we are seeing similar results over time builds our confidence that we are doing the proper analyses.
Thank you. Would you like to take the next question?
Please.
Doyle Rice, you may go ahead and please state your company name.
Good morning. It's Doyle Rice from USA Today. Just a question. I, based on the best scientific research you all have seen there, would it be fair to say this is likely the warmest year in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands? I know there's been different numbers and different studies out there, but it's just a rough estimate of based on paleoclimatic data. Are we talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or more?
Let me jump in here. So we have good information about individual years, you know, going back a few hundred years from paleo data sources. And so 2016 is very likely to be the warmest year for many hundreds of years. As we go back further in time, our ability to pick out individual years is less. And so we can only have, like, you know, confident statements about, you know, decadal means, or, and as we go further back, centennial means. And so we, so comparing, you know, the last decade to, or the last 50 years to periods in the recent Holocene, so a few thousand years, you know, there's some evidence, I think, and I think it's growing evidence that we're doing something that's unique in a millennial context. If you go back to, you know, the early Holocene, when we expect the planet, particularly in the northern hemisphere, to have been a little bit warmer than it is now because of the orbital configuration of the planet, there's no evidence of a period that is as warm as the period that we're going through, but we can't say anything about individual years. And so then the period before that, where I think we could confidently say that the global mean was warmer than it is today, was indeed 125,000 years ago during the last interglacial.
Okay, thanks. That helps.
Thank you. Mary Boyle, you may ask your question, and please state your company name.
Hi, this is Mary Boyle with NHK Japan Broadcasting. Thank you for doing this conference today. I think this may have been answered, but just to be safe, I'm going to ask it again. So, again, we keep seeing the words the 20th century average, and so is it not possible to say exactly what this number is, what the exact temperature is? Thank you.
Hi, this is Deke. So we consider the 20th century average to be about 57 degrees Fahrenheit. As Gavin articulated earlier, it is actually much more direct and much more precise to measure change over time rather than to try to calculate the temperature of the planet. So we consider the 20th century average to be 57.0 degrees Fahrenheit here at NOAA. But again, we have placed much more precision in our estimates of change and the relative temperature of one year to another over time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea Thompson, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
Hi, yes, I'm from Climate Central. So I was wondering, I guess first, Gavin, what exceptional warmth we've seen in the Arctic is kind of what's giving you some confidence that 2017 is going to be still ranked so high. And then for either of you, when you kind of rebaseline these numbers to closer to pre-industrial times, we're edging really close to that goal of 1.5C. So I don't know what your expectations are until, you know, how quickly we might reach that goal and whether that's kind of realistic.
So this is a little bit beyond what we can just say from the data at hand. We have, I think, clearly passed 1 degree above pre-industrial temperatures, and I think it is unlikely that we will go below that, short of a temporary effect from a big volcano, for instance. But how quickly we'll get to 1.5 and then what the prospects are of staying below that in a longer-term context, that's really a question that depends on the rate at which we are continuing to emit carbon, the remaining carbon budget for 1.5, which is somewhat uncertain. But we're closer than we would like to be, I think, But the exact timing of these things is still a little opaque.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Tom Henry, you may go ahead and please state your company name.
Yeah, Tom Henry with the Toledo Blade. Being a Great Lakes guy, I just wondered if there is, first, I have two questions, but the first one was if there's anything especially unique to this region. Looking at the graphics, I didn't see, you know, anything that really jumped out about the Great Lakes. I know about the, you know, the trending data here, but I didn't know if you had any thoughts to help localize this for a Great Lakes reader. And then the other thing, and I don't mean this to sound as political as it might, but the geopolitics, most people obviously don't live up in the Arctic, and climate change is not evenly distributed. We all know that, but what kind of a challenge does that pose to communications for NASA and NOAA, getting people to empathize, you know, with the Arctic? What is it, you know, how do you bring that story home to people down in this part of the world? What's happening in the Arctic could affect Earth systems, and ultimately them in some ways too.
Hey, this is Deke from NOAA. So as far as detail in the Great Lakes period, it was a warm and wet year for much of the Great Lakes area, especially the western Great Lakes. If you'd like to talk a little more detail, I can walk you through our U.S. report, which was released a few days back. As far as the role that the Arctic plays, even within the climate system itself, the Arctic is very important. And that is, it is very white, for lack of a better term. There's a lot of ice up there, and as that snow and ice goes away, especially during the times of year when the sun is high in the sky, which is when we're seeing the most retreat of snow and ice up in the Arctic, that feeds back into the climate system. So it is connected with the climate system that we share around the globe. It is an important climate driver, and it is an important climate indicator. It is also a part of the world that, as it becomes more accessible, it will be more important to monitor and to keep track of what's going on climate-wise in the Arctic.
And where could I see the? Is it on your website, the national report that you said might have more on an ecosystem basis?
Yeah, if you can email Brady, he can send you the link and get you in touch with an expert that can talk with you about the regional climate.
Okay. Also, if you go to NOAA.gov, it's on the main web homepage for NOAA.gov. There's a link to it. Yep, or I can send it to you. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question or do have any comments, you may press star followed by the number 1. Again, that is star 1. Timothy Kama, you may ask your question, and please state your company name.
Hi, this is Timothy Kama from The Hill. Sorry if you covered this before, but what is the extent, you believe, of human influence on this record and just the recent slate of records that we've been seeing?
So if I can take that. So what you're really asking is about the attribution of the trends. Hold on a second. The attribution of the trends is a model-based exercise. So global climate models to look at all of the different impacts individually, the natural impacts like volcanoes and solar changes and the orbital change, and then human impacts like carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases, aerosols. Hold on just a second. I've got another call coming in. And when we do that, what we find is we find the individual fingerprints for all of those different things, and then we look at all the data sets, not just the surface air temperatures, but the data sets in the upper atmosphere and stratosphere and in the deep ocean, we can put together an attributable component. And what happens is that the greenhouse gases would actually have warmed the climate a little bit more than we've actually seen, but that's been somewhat cancelled out by other human impacts, such as air pollution and land use change. But effectively, the natural component over this time period is very close to zero, and so pretty much all of the long-term trend that you're seeing is in fact attributable to human activity, and the dominant part of that is the increase in greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Sophia Rosenbaum, you may ask your question and please state your company name.
Hi, Sophia Rosenbaum with the New York Post. I just wanted you guys to talk a little bit more about how this is bigger than just 2016 because it's now a three-year trend.
Hi there. This is Deek from NOAA. It's actually a multi-decade trend. So we focus on these annual, because of the cycle of our annual reporting, we tend to focus on the previous year. But as far as what's most important to us going forward, it is the long-term trend that is the most relevant. So this is 2016 being the warmest year on record. Is a data point at the end of many data points that indicate several decades of warming that continues. I think that's where it's the most relevant in context.
And at this time, I am showing no further questions. Again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question.
And again, this is Brady Phillips from NOAA, so this is our last call. We are approaching, we do have some more folks, so.
And Sarah Lewin, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
I'm Sarah Lewin with space.com. I was wondering whether you could describe a little more why the estimate of change is more precise than the estimate of the total global temperature.
Gavin here. That's a great question. And so it relates to the fact that the weather that we feel has large scales to it. So when you see a storm system coming across the U.S., the scale of that storm system can be 1,000 miles across. And that means that everywhere that's being affected by that storm is really going to have the same ups and downs associated with that pattern, regardless of whether they're in the south or in the north. If you look at the difference in absolute temperature, say between New York and Washington D.C. or Montreal in Canada, you'll see maybe 15 degrees Fahrenheit difference on any one day or in the monthly. The monthly average. But whether one month was warmer or colder than another is actually very strongly correlated across those three places, even though they're hundreds of miles apart. And so by working with the changes, we're able to extrapolate over a wider area, and we're able to check more of the data from different stations against each other for consistency. And actually make estimates of the global mean with actually very relatively few stations to get a good answer. Whereas if we're trying to calculate the absolute temperature, we have to take into account where there are mountains, where there are forests, where there are inlets, and we really don't have that kind of coverage. So we have to do a lot more statistical interpolation to get the absolute temperature, whereas the anomalous temperature, the changes, it's actually much easier. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Kneeler, you may ask your question and please state your company name.
Hi, my name is Eric Kneeler with Wired. I'm curious about the role of the oceans in buffering some of this heat, and I realize that that's not your field of study, but if you could talk about some of the linkages between the atmosphere and the oceans, and is some of this heat going into a warming waters and expansion, thermal expansion. Just give me an explanation there.
Hi, this is Deke from NOAA, and you're correct. The atmosphere and the ocean are connected both at the weather scale, but especially on the longer term. So Gavin mentioned earlier that greenhouse gases are trapping heat, and that heat is playing into the warming that we're observing in our stations around the world. It turns out that about 90% of the heat that is trapped by greenhouse gases is actually going into the oceans, particularly the upper layers of the oceans. And so they are something of a savings account for a lot of the additional heating that we've seen. So in any given year with atmospheric observations, we are only observing a small fraction of the total amount of heating that's going on in the climate system, and the majority of that heating is happening in the oceans.
Can I add one little thing to that, which I think is quite important? One of the key conclusions that we can infer from the increasing amount of ocean heat content is the fact that the planet as a whole is gaining energy. And as Deke said, 90% of that energy that it's gaining is going into the ocean. That allows us to infer that what's causing the trends is in fact an external forcing that's changing the radiation balance of the whole planet. So the sun could be doing that, the carbon dioxide could be doing that, but we can rule out the sun because the pattern of warming that you would get from a solar change in the altitude as you go up from the surface of the atmosphere look like the pattern that we get, and it looks much more like the pattern that you get with greenhouse gases. And so the ocean heat content change is not just important in its own sake for instance, sea level rise and for changes in the environment of the upper ocean, but it's also a key element in our ability to understand why things are changing the way they are.
Thank you. And our last question comes from Todd Battis. You may go ahead and please state your company name.
Thank you. Hi, Todd Battis with CTV News, Canadian Network Television. I'm just wondering if you can reiterate a statement you made earlier, and I believe it was Gavin who made the comment about temperatures in the Western Arctic, in particular Northern Canada, and what the concern is for that region.
So as you can see from the map on slide two, temperatures across the whole of the Arctic were extremely warm this year, in particular around Alaska. And so when you obviously are already seeing impacts from that, you're seeing increased coastal erosion, you're seeing increased permafrost melt, you're seeing, methane emissions, carbon dioxide emissions coming from thawing permafrost. You're seeing changes in water resources, surfaces, roads are being damaged, pipelines are being damaged, as you're well aware. And, of course, ecosystems are changing quite severely. So, bushes are moving into the tundra, and creatures that really depend on the sea ice and snow are moving further north as they can. So, there are the direct effects of the changes in the Arctic are evident to anybody who spends time there.
Thank you.
Okay, that is our last call. Thank you again to everyone who asked questions and to Gavin and Deke for answering them. Basically, if you do have any other further information needs, please feel free to email me again, Brady, B-R-A-D-Y, .PHILLIPS@NOAA.gov, or my colleague at NASA, and I'll give you one person, Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, .M.MCCARTHY, that's Leslie M. McCarthy, @NASA.gov. We do have a number of emails in the queue, so please be patient, and we will get to you as soon as we can. And also, if you are interested in reviewing an audio version of this call, I will have it posted on the media advisory that I sent out on NOAA.gov within 60 to 90 minutes. It depends how long it takes to process it. Again, this does conclude the call, and thank you, everybody, for participating. Goodbye.
Thank you. This concludes today's Climate Conference call. You may go ahead and disconnect at this time.